Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Floridians for Lawsuit Reform. Property insurance bills in Florida have been skyrocketing due to rising litigation affecting millions of Floridians. Learn more about solutions at fltortreform.com. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Are Florida's college and university students receiving a wide diversity of opinions and viewpoints in their classes? State lawmakers want to know.
What we're getting at is whether students feel are self-censoring because they believe that they are going to be penalized for sharing constitutionally protected viewpoints.
Also tonight, despite frantic lobbying from affordable housing advocates, the Florida legislature moves ahead to divert money from the Affordable Housing Trust Fund to fighting sea level rise.
It's like the one issue that every single one of our districts can agree upon.
We'll also get an update on how Florida might proceed redrawing state legislative and congressional district lines. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day four of week six in the 2021 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. Governor Ron DeSantis will get the final say on whether to require Florida's public colleges and universities to conduct annual surveys on free speech. The proposal cleared the Senate on a mostly party-line vote, and with little comment, the chamber adopted the House's version of the bill, which cleared that chamber about 2 weeks ago. Lynn Hatter recaps the House debate over the proposal.
For years, Republicans have floated the plan of an annual survey to see whether colleges and universities are more liberal or conservative. It's predicated on the belief that the schools are indoctrinating students toward liberal views, and Windermere Democratic Representative Geraldine Thompson said as much in remarks opposing the legislation.
Cancel culture is an issue today because it is suspected. The idea is advanced that our colleges and universities are teaching liberal views. Certainly, we don't want that. So we need a survey to prove what someone has already decided exists.
A Pew Research report issued in 2019 notes the views about higher education have become increasingly polarized, with more Republicans becoming dissatisfied and suspicious about the role colleges have in society, on everything from admission decisions to free speech. Bill sponsor, Republican Representative Spencer Roach of North Fort Myers, says his proposal is based on, quote, anecdotal stories he and others have heard about students being penalized for their views or even self-censoring.
Look, certainly students have a right, and any of us have a right not to be compelled to speak if we want to withhold our views for any variety of reasons. But I think that what we're getting at is whether students feel are self-censoring because they believe that they are going to be penalized for sharing constitutionally protected viewpoints, either through their grades or through some other sort of punitive actions.
Roach acknowledges the surveys could be used for policy decisions down the line. The measure is a slippery one for Democrats, college and university administrators, and professors who are concerned about losing their rights to free speech if something they say or do is contested by a student. They're also worried they won't be able to control situations that could become violent or volatile. During a previous committee hearing on the bill, Tallahassee Democratic Representative Ramon Alexander asked whether Florida A&M University, a predominantly black school, could bar the KKK, a white supremacist group, from speaking on its campus. And during floor debate, Roach sidestepped the question, which was posed by Thompson.
Universities have spaces and auditoriums, and they have a process, usually an online reservation system, to book places to hold meetings or give speakers or present ideas. But we're not saying that you have the liberty now to march into the cafeteria or march into a classroom in full stride and have a rally. That's not what this is doing.
The short answer, no, schools could not block controversial speakers from their campuses, though they could still place additional constraints on them. Palm Beach County Democratic Representative Omari Hardy questioned Roach repeatedly on whether supporters of the bill see potential for problems stemming from the legislation. Hardy points to circumstances where perpetrators of abuse could use the bill to play the victim. He uses the example of a student who distributes nude photos of another student and claims it as an art project.
By the way, that act would not be covered under our state's revenge porn statutes. In each and every single case, the offending student could conceivably recast the professor or the faculty member's attempt to gain control of the academic environment as an attempt to shield or limit other students from observing expressive material, however unwelcome. And that's concerning. It also gives that student a cause of action. So now the offender becomes the victim, and the person who is attempting to protect the actual victim now is in court.
Roach says the bill is merely an optional survey, one designed to measure attitudes on campuses. The plan also allows students to record class lectures without the consent of other students or the professor. Those recordings can be used in complaints or for personal use, something Roach notes already happens, though not the complaint part. I'm Len Hatter.
The Florida legislature has passed a measure meant to permanently reallocate funds from the state's affordable housing programs to help pay for the governor's environmental initiatives. But as Robbie Gaffney reports, a compromise will cap future sweeps of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund.
An initial proposal would have taken about two-thirds of the dollars typically allocated for state and local government housing projects and reallocated the money for environmental spending. A new plan returns some of those affordable housing funds, leaving the programs with a minimum of $200 million rather than the initially proposed $141 million. Bartow Republican Senator Ben Albritton sponsored the change.
In the Appropriations Committee, there was some robust discussion about this bill and the distributions and concerns about the funding levels, specifically on the affordable housing piece. So what the amendment does is it changes the distribution in this way.
Some of the money currently allocated for affordable housing will permanently go toward the new Resilient Florida Trust Fund to help communities combat the impacts of sea level rise and flooding. It will also support a wastewater grant program. Lawmakers are planning to give those programs about $111 million each, but not everyone is on board with the plan. Senate Democrats have raised concerns about the proposal. Boca Raton Democratic Senator Tina Polsky is one of them.
There's the constant sweeping of the Affordable Trust Fund that we've had every year, I think since its inception, and there's such a huge need for it. And it's like the one issue that every single one of our districts can agree upon.
Polsky says she appreciates the bump in money to affordable housing compared to what lawmakers had originally pitched this year. But she says the proposed $200 million is not enough.
Supply and demand. There is not enough supply of general housing, and with real estate prices going up and up, that just means that even the lowest, level of housing has gone up. And so there, every time we have more money in doc stamps means we have more need for affordable housing at the lower levels.
Polsky also says permanently redirecting dollars that had been earmarked for affordable housing could backfire if there's another housing crisis.
We're not going to be able to use all the money that the housing fund has, because now we're required to put it towards other projects. And those projects are worthy, but I believe that there are other areas where we can take that money from.
During a discussion on the House version of the bill, Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Eskamani asked if federal dollars from COVID-19 aid could be used to fund those environmental projects.
Could we use American Rescue Plan money to fulfill the same goal of this legislation? Do we have to use money out of the Affordable Housing Trust Funds?
Sponsor of the House bill, Auburndale Republican Representative Josie Tomko, points out more money could be put into affordable housing programs. She says the proposed $200 million are just a minimum.
We are putting this dollar amount as the minimum that this trust fund can receive. And by doing that, that is to say that if more money does come our way, it can be added. But us as a state legislature are saying no more can this be swept, and this is the minimum amount that it will be set as.
Senate President Wilton Simpson has cheered the move, saying the new distributions of the documentary stamp tax will ensure a steady stream of funding in three key areas of infrastructure: affordable housing, wastewater, and mitigation of sea level rise. The proposal is now heading to the governor's desk. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
Delayed U.S. Census data will push back Florida's redistricting efforts, but voter advocacy groups are already working to ensure the process of redrawing the state's electoral maps is fair. Valerie Crowder reports legislation has been introduced this session to make sure state legislative and congressional maps are drawn in the open.
Democratic State Senator Annette Tadeo of Miami is sponsoring a bill that would remove a public records exemption for drafts of redistricting plans. Tadeo is also the vice chair of the State Senate Ethics and Elections Committee. She spoke about the measure Thursday during a conference call with voter advocates.
We talk about the state of Florida as the Sunshine State, but some of the politicians here in Tallahassee love to keep things in secret. This bill would make sure that these type of meetings are done in the sunshine, that everything is open and on the record, so that you as the voters, you as the organizations that are interested in this are a part of it and aware. None of these backroom deals that we know happen up here all the time.
The measure hasn't yet been considered in committee. Fair District's now chairwoman, Ellen Frieden, helped lead the effort to get a state constitutional amendment approved in 2010, requiring the drawing of the state's electoral maps use city, county, and geographical boundaries, and that districts are as equal in population as feasible. She says she supports Tadeo's bill because it would allow the public to better monitor the process, ensuring lawmakers comply with the state constitution.
We know that in 2012, there was anything but transparency. While proclaiming transparency, the legislature was actually engaged in drawing maps in the back rooms of the Republican political party headquarters. And we proved that, and we ended up proving that in court. We don't ever want to see anything like that happening again.
Frieden says shedding more light on the map drawing process would help prevent political gerrymandering this time around.
If the legislature actually does map drawing in a transparent way, it'll be clear not only to us, but to the public and to all legislators, frankly, because I don't think even all legislators understood what was really going on last time.
Frieden says her organization isn't stopping with support for this bill.
The Fair Districts Coalition is prepared to do just about whatever it takes to ensure that there are fair maps in this state. It's way too early to know. We have great hope and want to have confidence that the legislature is going to do the right thing this time. And we will be assessing as we go every step of the way, and we'll be using every tool in our toolbox to ensure that the maps are drawn fairly.
Nearly a decade ago, the League of Women Voters and others took the state to court over its electoral maps. The court ruled against the state, finding that Republican state lawmakers had manipulated congressional district boundaries to ensure the GOP held a majority. The League's president, Patricia Brigham, says they're not ruling out taking similar legal action if the maps aren't drawn fairly this time.
We are prepared to do everything that we can do to make sure that we have fair districts and that the process is transparent and open. Everything we can do.
U.S. Census data taken every 10 years informs the redistricting process. States are expected to receive that data in September. The Florida legislature will later reconvene to begin redrawing congressional and state legislative district maps. In the meantime, voter advocate groups are urging state lawmakers to sign a pledge committing to a fair redistricting process. I'm Valerie Crowder.
Big changes are looming after the Florida Senate passed a measure to wean the state from its present defined benefit pension system. Kevin DeLorterbay reports on the skepticism coming from unions and Democratic lawmakers.
Currently, the Florida retirement system benefits more than 1 million active and retired employees. It's one of the largest public retirement plans in the country, and it's for that reason Republican Senator Ray Rodriguez filed SB 84. His measure will require new state workers to enroll in a 401k retirement plan instead of FRS. Rodriguez says the state faces $36 billion in unfunded actuarial liabilities, which means the state pension funds don't have enough assets to cover the hundreds of thousands of workers who will seek their retirement plans in years to come. The bill was recently passed by the Senate, with Rodriguez saying switching the state's retirement plan is the only way the state can ensure it has enough funds to pay workers their pensions in the long run.
So what we're attempting to do with this is to, one, make sure that we can keep the promises that we have made to the employees who are in the system by shifting new employees into the defined contribution plan. Going forward, the new employees will be in a defined contribution plan. We will contribute a percentage. They will contribute their 3%. The goal being that we are no longer adding to the unfunded actuarial liability, which has continued to grow.
The bill faces opposition from unions and Democratic lawmakers. They say the measure essentially undoes the state's major bargaining chip when hiring potential state employees. During the bill's second reading, Democratic Senator Lorraine Ausley showed her opposition to the bill.
This bill represents a major change in the Florida retirement system. And while the argument has been made that these changes only apply to non-special risk employees hired after July 1, 2022, the fact is, and history has shown us, that any changes we make to the front end of the system, who pays in, who can opt out, who defaults out, the amounts that are paid in, all of these changes are very likely to have an impact on the back end of the system, on the long-term viability of the entire system itself.
Senator Lori Berman, a Democrat from Palm Beach, asked Rodriguez if this switch would threaten current state employee pensions if future employees are no longer pitching in towards the fund.
The employees who are paying in their 3% now per employee. That money is theirs, regardless of whether they vest or do not vest. So the unfunded actuarial will not grow because we're no longer getting money from those employees. The money that they're paying in was always their money and will always be their money, and will be their money whether this bill passes or fails.
Rodriguez was also asked if other states have made this switch. He says they have, and in some instances, it didn't go well. Rodriguez believes in many of those circumstances, states made the switch too late. But he says in Florida's case, the time is now.
We're operating in a position now where our plan is 82% funded. Our plan is in a position of stability, and this is the time to make the change while we have the ability to do that from a position of strength.
And he says the measure is needed for long-term stability.
This isn't being done to save money, not for this year's budget, not for next year's budget. And it's not being done because we're looking at a cost savings 30 years down the road. This is a generational change that is being made to ensure that we can keep the promises we've made to the 400,000 employees who are currently retired, to the 600,000 employees who are currently enrolled in the plan in either Tier 1 or Tier 2.
The bill is now headed to the full House. I'm Kevin DeLorbe.
Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, there have been few silver linings, but health experts say one good thing is an expansion of telehealth. Regan McCarthy reports a proposal to keep many of the state's pandemic-era telehealth practices in place is moving forward, but some say a few important provisions appear to be missing.
One of the few positive things that has happened because of COVID is the expanded use of telehealth. We found out that telehealth works. It works for providers, but more importantly, it works for the patients of the state of Florida.
Chris Newland works with the Florida chapter of the American College of Physicians.
While there need to be guardrails on things like controlled substance prescribing, we have to acknowledge that this expansion, as put forth in Senator Rodriguez's bill, works, and it will increase access to quality medicine for patients throughout the state of Florida.
Newland spoke earlier in the session about a bill by Doral Republican Senator Ana Maria Rodriguez. She says telemedicine can be a helpful option for people who might otherwise struggle to get access to care because they're a long drive from their doctor or they don't have reliable transportation.
Telemedicine is a voluntary service, and it does not mandate replacement of in-person visits for those who desire them. It is simply another option meant to allow for greater healthcare access.
That's something Stewart Republican Senator Gail Harrell says she can certainly agree with.
I did the original bill. You know, we took us about 5 years to finally pass a bill on telehealth. And I think we have now, through the pandemic, really realized how important it is.
But Harrell says there's something missing from Rodriguez's bill.
I noticed that it did not include, that it does not include some of the aspects of the executive order that was allowed for telehealth during the pandemic, where specifically surgeons were allowed to do for their medication continuation for their follow-up for surgery, this 14-day period, which physicians normally see the patient sometimes regularly and change their medication, especially their Schedule II medication to deal with pain.
That's something Harrell says the governor's order has allowed during the pandemic, and something Rodriguez says she would consider adding to her measure as it moves through the committee process. Another provision that's allowed under the governor's order lets patients renew their medical marijuana recommendations with their doctors remotely. Rodriguez's bill doesn't allow that. It's an issue that caused confusion during a recent Senate committee meeting. Hialeah Gardens Republican Senator Manny Diaz stepped in to explain. He's talking here with Fort Lauderdale Democratic Senator Gary Farmer.
So what
it recertification?
I believe what she said.
But it would bar the
right. I believe what she said is in a different way is that it doesn't affect current law. But the confusion I think arises, as Mr. Watson brought forward, is that it's in the emergency order, but it's not in law.
Farmer says he'd like to see medical marijuana renewals included as part of the legislation.
Medical marijuana is medicine, plain and simple. And there are other, I think, substances that arguably could be considered as or more dangerous that you can renew prescriptions via telehealth. And I would just really hope that we can work on that part of it and allow for recertification.
Rodriguez says she's not opposed to considering that going forward, but she's heard pleas in previous committee meetings to include medical marijuana renewals in her measure and has not done so yet. The measure has one committee stop left to go. I'm Regan McCarthy.
There's an old saying around Tallahassee, you can always tell when the session is getting close to the end. The amount of legislative activity on Fridays starts ramping up. Here's Gina Jordan.
Here's some of what's coming up at the Capitol. The Combating Public Disorder Bill, also known as the Anti-Riot Bill, makes its final committee stop in the Senate. The House has already passed the bill. It's aimed at cracking down on violent protests by creating a host of new crimes and enhancing riot-related penalties. Governor Ron DeSantis floated the idea last year after widespread protests sparked by the death of George Floyd, a Minneapolis black man who died after a white police officer knelt on his neck. A public records exemption may be created for information about the home addresses, telephone numbers, and dates of birth of state lawmakers, cabinet members, and their immediate family members. A House Education Subcommittee will consider requiring high school students to receive training in CPR. Another subcommittee will hold a workshop on insulin insurance costs. It comes as proposed legislation would place a $100 cap on cost-sharing requirements for 30-day supplies of insulin. And finally, a proposal specifies the goals of children in shelters or foster care. Among other things, it requires the Department of Children and Families to operate with the understanding that the rights of these children are critical to their safety and well-being. It requires DCF to work with all stakeholders to help children become knowledgeable about their rights. That's some of what's happening tomorrow in the Florida legislature. I'm Gina Jordan.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a generation has passed in Florida since the state last had a Democratic governor. His name was Kenneth Buddy McKay, and he's still around. Steve Bosquet paid a visit recently to get McKay's take on the current state of Florida politics.
Buddy McKay turned 88 years old last month. He and his wife Anne live in a charming old Florida-style house on a large freshwater lake in Marion County near Ocala. McKay calls it downtown Ocklawaha. For 26 years, McKay was a low-key but forceful presence in Florida as a legislator, congressman, and lieutenant governor under Lawton Childs, the last elected Democratic governor. He recalled how he and Childs' wife, Rhea, persuaded Childs to run for governor in 1990.
Rhea Childs had a lot to do with that. I went to Lawton and said, Lawton,
somebody's got to do something. This state's going to hell in a handbasket. And Lawton was, he was, you know, he had a way of kind of rubbing his chin and not committing himself. And Rhea said, Lawton is right. She said, you all need to do something. And that really was where he got back in it. And I think that was kind of the turning point.
McKay's story is one of bad political timing and hard luck as a statewide candidate. He ran statewide 3 times and lost every time, twice for U.S. Senate and once for governor. Each time he was hounded by the perception that he was too liberal.
I think it was sort of hidden. It was always known as a liberal, L-I-B-R-U-L, liberal. That liberal from Gainesville. Well, I mean, it's something I had to live with. I didn't consider myself a liberal. I considered myself an independent who was voting for the future of Florida. But
McKay's wife, Ann, was his partner on those long and often frustrating campaigns. She turned emotional when she was asked how she would like her husband to be remembered.
He thought that he wasn't a politician. Mm-hmm. That he was honest and, you made me cry, honest and thoughtful, about 10 years ahead of his son. Mm-hmm. That got him into a lot of trouble. It did.
McKay was a strong believer in racial integration before that was popular, and he had a strong environmental record. He was an early supporter of abortion rights. Like many Democrats, McKay is deeply distressed by what he sees in Tallahassee today and feels the state has fallen far short of its potential. He sees Florida as rootless, with a constantly shifting population of people with little sense of the state's history, which makes it harder to resolve long-standing problems.
Florida kind of lacks a center. It lacks a view of it. It lacks a central worldview. And I think as a result of that, we're going to be treated as a lightweight operation always. I don't see anything changing much.
McKay's last campaign for governor in 1998 ended with a loss to Jeb Bush. He fell short, though he had a catchy campaign song written by Sunrise songwriter Frank LoCanto. McKay served as governor for 3 weeks after Childs died suddenly of a heart attack. He briefly got to be governor, but not the way he wanted. In Ocklawaha, I'm Steve Bosquet.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Kevin Del Orbe and Steve Bosquet. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us every evening at this time throughout the 2021 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Floridians for Lawsuit Reform. Property insurance bills in Florida have been skyrocketing due to rising litigation affecting millions of Floridians. Learn more about solutions at fltortreform.com.